March 7, 2014, in the Vienna, Slovenia, Organizational Culture and Structure, Part 2. All right. Unfortunately, we don't have time to do all of this. So I'm wondering if you have some thoughts about where we fit in here. So the questions that you've been able to answer, the meditation you've done on these different ones in the six areas, do you get some sense about what are we looking at? Norms and principles centered around people and cooperation, mutual adjustment on ideas and knowledge and collaboration, meeting our promises based on resources and competition, or formal rules based on processes and skills and control. Any thoughts? Or any questions or any discussion?
It seems that it overlaps.
Okay.
You know,
what did you find mostly? Did you find anything mostly?
I noticed both things.
Well, there's four, so I don't know what you mean by both.
Flexibility or stability or external or internal.
Okay, but which of these four do you in your area, which area were you looking at?
Regulatory structure.
Regulatory structure. Which did you find that it was most like, just in the area of regulatory structure? What were you finding?
So that's the internal part, and that's the flexibility. The emphasis on people.
So you found an emphasis on people?
Yeah.
Okay. What other things did you find? What governing principles did you find? You're looking at regulatory structures, right?
Yeah.
Was there a cooperative, collaborative, controlling, or competing mood that you find?
Competing, no.
Definitely not competing, okay.
Okay.
Just again, in your area that you were looking at just now. What was the mood then? Cooperation, control, or collaborating? Okay, cooperation is you're working together, but there's a very clear higher and lower. And collaboration, you're working together, and there's not a very clear higher and lower.
Okay, cooperation.
So more cooperation. Okay. Would you say that governed by more norms and principles, by rules, by meeting commitments, or by mutual adjustments? More by meeting commitments. That's interesting. Okay, so you found a family culture in terms of people and cooperation, but a market culture more in terms of meeting commitments. Meeting commitments means that whenever the way that we govern things is for each situation, we make an agreement. And then our ideas, we make that agreement. There may be different rules all the time. There may be even different principles all the time. But we may, I'm going to do this and you're going to do that. And then the way we're governed is we hold each other to our agreement. Okay, what did you find in terms of stories?
We had different kinds of stories. Some were like, both were like, could be like to the extreme. Like, for instance, what kind of stories do people tell about the history of their organization?
Uh-huh.
We also find that they tell very kind stories, and they're kind of there is a kind of cooperation. One finds in a loving family. There was one extreme, and another was that there individuals or groups trying to control each other.
Okay, but those were the negatives.
Yes.
Okay, so if your stories about the bad guys are the guys who try to control, and your story about the good guys are the guys who act like a family, then that shows you have a family culture. In our stories, we make who's the good guy and who's the bad guy.
No, these were two different stories.
It doesn't matter. If the story's about control or story's about bad things. See, if you have a hierarchical culture, then your stories about control will be stories about good things. That'll be a good thing. Then you have, you know, a great story that there was this temple, it was a mess, nobody was following any of the rules, and, you know, Krishna Das went in there and pulled out the rule book and said, okay, everybody's got to follow these rules, and we're going to set up an organizational chart, and this is who's in charge, and everybody has to do things like this, and wow, now that temple is so nice, now everything's really under control. So you can have a story about control that's positive. If your culture is a hierarchical culture, then those will be the positive stories. Oh yeah, they could be two different stories. So what we're looking at in stories is, again, who are the heroes and who are the villains? What are the good stories? What are the bad stories? Stories is one of the prime ways that we communicate the culture of an organization. You know, if the stories we tell are, well, somebody started this new preaching center and they decided that they weren't going to mention the name Krishna for the first 6 months. You know, they were just going to talk about the absolute truth. And it was really controversial, and what we ended up making, you know, 100 devotees out of that. So that's a story about mutual adjustments, and that's a story about ideas and knowledge. Do you follow? Do you understand? Or if the stories we tell are, well, you know, we have this book marathon, and some people are, you know, we're going out there, and everybody's trying to get the best score, and the people who get the best score get a big maha plate. And if those are our stories, then we have a very competitive culture. Or if we tell a lot of stories about promises, you know, well, everybody who comes to the temple president says to them, you know, if you stay here for at least 10 years, we'll take care of you the rest of your life, and we sign a contract, and do people keep their promise? If we're really focused on, do people keep their agreements? If we're really focused on, are people competing? If we're really focused on, do people do things that are innovative? Or we really focus on, do people do things that are cooperative? So what are the stories focusing on? Who are they making the good guys? Who are they making the bad guys? What examples are the stories putting out for what we should follow? So did you find any overall trends like that?
I think people are in the family.
You're going again to the family. All right, so, Anantabhu, what were you looking at again?
Procedures and routines.
Procedures and routines, like what people expect when they come and stuff. So, did you find anything that would indicate something about the culture?
Here are two questions about what behaviors would these routines and procedures encourage in people, in which way? Some mixture, because it's a little bit awkward because there are different procedures, and it's deep worship is like very
has a different sort of procedure.
Yeah, hierarchical, and then some other, I don't know, Sushum Sam is something different, opposite way. So, but in general, what we found is like a more incorporative.
You found also some more cooperative behaviors?
Yeah, in general.
I mean, and a good example of that would be, I know one family where they have a chart as to who's supposed to do what job in the family. So somebody's supposed to count out the plates and spoons for meals. And they don't have anyone who's supposed to serve a meal, so that's always, you know, who's going to serve a meal. But there's someone who gets out the plates, there's somebody who takes the dirty plates and puts them in the sink, there's somebody who washes the plates, there's someone else who puts away the clean plates. There's someone who cooks. There's someone who cleans the kitchen. And they have their very, you know, who does which job. And in that family, people will not do other people's jobs, generally. I mean, they very rarely will do other people's jobs. So if someone's sick, then they have to trade with someone. They have to, you know. It's not that someone's just going to say, oh, they're sick, I'll do their job. Then they have to negotiate. Okay, you know, I'm sick, can you count the plates out? Seriously. Then, I go to other families where there's no standard at all about who does anything. So anybody just goes. There was one family where it was a husband and wife staying with his mother, and the husband and wife had an older daughter. So you had both the husband, the wife, the daughter, and the mother all knew how to cook. So who was going to cook? And they told me, well, it was whoever gets in the kitchen first and just starts cooking. So, you know, the one family, their cooking was like on Monday this person cooks, on Tuesday this person cooks, on Monday. That's how they organized things. And the other family, you had four possibilities of who could cook, and you never knew. You know, you might be planning that you're going to make something, and you go in the kitchen, and somebody else is already there, and they're already cooking. So you go, oh, I guess today I don't cook. So those are different procedures, and they encourage different kinds of behavior. You know, the procedure where everybody had their allocated job did not encourage cooperative behavior at all. It encouraged, you know, a control behavior. It definitely did not encourage cooperation. And the one where, you know, you never knew who was going to cook when to cook, that really kind of encouraged collaborative or competitive, one of the two. Either they were collaborating or they were competing. Who was going to get in there first, or who was going to be slow and get in there last, you know? And that was very mutual adjustment. It was being decided on a day-to-day basis. You know, oh, you're already cooking, you know, but I wanted to cook today. Is it all right if I cooked? Even though, you know, how far have you started? Can I cook instead? Oh, sure, you know, or oh, no, I really want to make some. And then they would decide it so it would encourage different kinds of behaviors. Does that help? And by the way, one isn't good and one isn't bad. They're just simply very different. You know, both families eat. Yeah. And in both families the dishes get washed, but their culture was opposite. So any thoughts about the general culture that you found for the procedures?
Collaborates one of
those. You found a lot of collaboration, okay.
Some elements, okay. Because it's very special in problems.
Okay, so you especially tend to deal with problems with formal rules. That's quite interesting. Okay, what was your group looking at?
Authority.
The lines of authority. So do you have any feelings about what culture the lines of authority particularly show? Mostly family. Okay. So previous was more hierarchy.
Yeah, more hierarchy, yes.
And now it's gone more to a family.
Yeah, it's more warm.
Warmer, okay.
And also collaborative.
And also some collaborative. I'm not surprised that you find somewhat of a collaborative culture here, because the collaborative culture is a very Brahminical culture. And this temple, because this has, you have such a high emphasis on education and Shastra, you definitely have a more Brahminical mood here than you have in most temples. So I would expect that in this temple you can't have Brahmins without some level of adhocracy. Brahmins cannot function in any other culture except for an adhocracy culture. They just can't. They suffocate. So because you have such a high Brahminical atmosphere here, you must have aspects of an adhocracy culture. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to continue. If you tried to have lots and lots of Shastra classes and lots of you know, you'd kill it. So I'm not surprised that you're seeing that in the power structure. Okay, and what was your use with symbols, right? So what did you find?
More family
symbols. Okay. And you were looking at structure?
I'm lost.
You're still lost. Prabhu, if you were lost, you needed to ask for directions about 20 minutes ago and not just sit there being lost, okay? Okay. All right. So we could look at, we don't really have time to get into this in detail, But we could certainly, this is the kind of discussion that I suggest you have, that what cultural strength do we have right now, and where are things misaligned? You know, because what you'll look at in your present organization, you'll see, wow, this is the kind of culture we want to have, and these are the areas in which we're really achieving that, and these are some areas in which we're not really achieving that. So again, this is not something we just simply don't have the time to discuss this today. But this is the kind of discussion that's good to have. All right, now how do we become cultural engineers? How do we change culture? And how do we keep things that we want to keep and change what we don't want to keep? So first of all, to become aware of what our current culture is, and that's some of what we just did in the last exercise. And these are three big questions to ask. So the last exercise, we looked at certain areas of culture. Stories, symbols, structures, right, formalities. We broke it up into those little areas. But here we're looking at three kind of overall areas. So how do you socialize new people? So this is both children born into the movement and people who join. How do you train them in the culture? What do you train them to do? What's your process for training them in the organizational culture? And then you were talking, I thought it was very interesting, you talked about when there's some sort of a crisis, how, you know, where do you go to? We can tell a lot about our basic personality style or organizational culture by what we do in an emergency, what we do in a crisis. What do we go to? And because in a crisis, we drop pretense. Okay? So what actions are given and what reasons do we give? Why did we give these actions? What's our purpose for doing these things? Is our purpose to follow the rules? Is our purpose to create love and trust? Is our purpose to create more openness? Is our purpose to create the best? A lot of the competitive thing applies to how we treat what I would call our sister organizations also, with whom we're in competition. And then the last thing is to talk with people who are not in the organization. Because, again, what we're looking at is our assumptions. We're looking at the things that we don't know we have. We're looking at aspects of what we believe to be true that are not necessarily true, but that we just think that they're obvious. So the only way to see those really is to ask somebody who's out of the paradigm. So you could say to somebody who's not in the organization, okay, come and look at our organization. What things don't make any sense to you? What things are contradictory? What things are anomalies? I mean, I see that, and not here in Slovenia, but I see in many places in ISKCON that there's a very puzzling, contradictory anomaly between the way we talk about women and the way we treat women. And it's quite interesting, you know, that we say one thing and we do something very, very different. Again, I don't find that here, but some places are like that. In some places, it's like that with children. I was just having a discussion with a devotee from a temple where almost all the leaders are married and have children, where there's a lot of children in the community. But this devotee said, they're not going to want to do any project that involves teenagers. And I said, well, that's very peculiar because all the leaders there have children. And some of them have teenage children. You know, why aren't they into working with children? He said, they're just not. He said, anything you suggest that will deal with teenagers or young adults, they won't want anything to do with. So that's a puzzling anomaly. Puzzling, anomaly, contradictory are all different ways of saying the same thing. And somebody from the outside goes and says, well, this doesn't make sense. Why do you have, you know, you have this way of behaving that's not in line with your espoused ideals? What are some other... Anyway, I think you get some idea of what I'm talking about. Another example would be, we don't really have this so much anymore. We have to some extent. There was a time in ISKCON's history when we replaced book distribution with money collecting. You know, so that was an anomaly. It was something puzzling. You know, why are we sending people out just collecting money? That wasn't our espoused culture. Does that make sense to everybody? Because what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out what our unconscious or unknown beliefs are. So how do we change organizational culture? So this is especially on the part of leaders. This is particularly how people who have leadership, and leadership isn't just title. You can have a title and not be a leader, and you can be a leader and not have a title. Title and leadership are not necessarily the same thing. One of the biggest leaders in our Hare Krishna movement was Iyengar. And why do I say that? When Iyengar died, there was a huge worldwide response. Huge. Much bigger than when Sataputta died. When Sataputta died, people were like, who? I mean, I think Sataputta made one of the most important contributions to the preaching of Lord Chaitanya's movement and Prabhupada's mission of anybody on the planet. But seriously, when he died, I think I was in Radhadesh at the time, a lot of people said, who? I mean, another person in a similar field was Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj. You know, when he left his body, it was a little bit more response, but again, not much. There wasn't much of a worldwide response, although he, again, arguably did some of the most groundbreaking service on an international level in terms of science and in terms of culture. But when Iyengar died, it was a big thing all over the world. And it went on for months and months and months and months. Generally, when somebody dies, you know, there's something for a day or maybe a week, except among people who knew them really, really well. But when Iyengar passed, when he left his body, I mean, it was at least 4 months that there was a strong international reaction. And he had no title at all. I mean, oh, he was the head of the 24-hour kirtan in Vrindavan. That's not much of a title.
It's next to nothing.
I mean, Vrindavan's one of our world headquarters, but still, does anyone know the leaders of the 24-hour kirtan in Mayapur? I don't know any of them. But he was definitely a leader in the Hare Krishna movement, although he had no title. He had, you know, very little position, and he had no title. You follow?
He has no fear to express what he thinks.
That's also true, but we have many people like that. He wasn't, you know, that's not a rare commodity, for better or for worse. We have many people who are not afraid to say what they think, and we have many people who start some project and keep it going for 25 years. Many people who've run projects for 25 years.
Also, it's not pleasant.
But he's not alone like that. You know, I don't think if you break it down that you're going to find that he was special in those ways. Somehow or other, for reasons that we probably can't figure out. I don't think we can figure it out. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about why was Iyengar such a leader. Still is. Still. Years later, still. And that's not so much true for everybody. It just isn't. You know, why? And I've just decided I can't figure it out. Why do some people have so much more influence than others? I don't know. One devotee today was talking to me about doing some project via Facebook and how you can promote a devotional project via Facebook. And this devotee said, well, one way you can do it is by finding out what people's interests are. And he said, one way you can do that is by finding what sannyasis they follow. And he said, on Facebook, Indrajumna Swami is considered an interest. Like some people are interested in dogs and some people are interested in skiing. So Indrajumna Swami has so many followers. There's 14,000 people following him on Facebook. So the Facebook computer program considers him an interest. Whereas Bibi Govindaswamy, who I think writes some of the most interesting posts on Facebook, only has like 3,000 followers. Why? If you sit down and try to figure it out logically, you can't. You can't analyze it on a material level. Why do some people have more position as leaders than others? I don't know. I really don't know. I don't, you know, and my PhD is in leadership, so, you know, we don't know. There's all different ways of analyzing what makes a leader and different kinds of leaders and why certain people become leaders. But my point is, when we're saying leaders, these are four ways in which leaders change culture. A leader does not necessarily mean a person with a title. A person with a title may also be a leader. We would like for all of our people with titles to also be leaders.
Yeah.
But that's not true. Many people with titles are not leaders. And it's also the fact that many people without titles are leaders. So these are symbolic ways. These are ways that communicate culture to people indirectly. What do you pay attention to? This is huge. We only do what's measured. Human beings only do what's measured. At least you have to measure it. If no one's measuring it, you won't do it. What do we pay attention to? You know, in most temples, we pay attention to books distributed and money collected. And that's generally about it. Occasionally, we pay attention to something else.
You mean like this devotee is more valuable because he brings more money or more assets?
Just what is noticed, as I talked about in that school where they had everything was about sports. What do you pay? What gets paid attention to? What gets talked about? What gets noticed? In teaching, we talk about four levels of teaching. What you say you teach, what you actually teach, what you teach openly, what you teach subtly, and what you don't talk about. What you don't teach. What you don't teach is the most powerful. So just like in the modern secular schools, they don't teach about God. That's very powerful. They're telling you for 12 years or 15 years, God isn't important, 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 God isn't important. By not teaching about it. So what we pay attention to and what we don't pay attention to drives culture and can change culture. A really simple example, husband and wife, and the wife is always criticizing the husband. He does this, he does that. I said, you know, all you have to do is keep a diary every day of the nice things your husband does. It's all you have to do, and you'll change the culture of the house. I said, you don't even have to say anything. You just have to write it down. Just keep it in a book for yourself. Whatever we pay attention to changes culture. It creates culture, and it changes culture. If there's something that you want to have more of, pay attention to it, and if there's something you want to have less of, ignore it. Their role modeling, teaching, and coaching. So this is more explicit. How do they behave? What do they do? I had an astonishing experience at the Navagokula farm in Brazil where the temple president came to every single one of my classes and seminars. I don't think I've ever experienced that anywhere in the world, ever. I was just astonished. I mean, I go to some temples where the authorities never come to my classes. You know, they'll invite me, but they never come. Which I always find a little interesting. You know, how do they know they want to invite me back? It's all secondhand. So what do you model? You know, what's your model? What do you do? How do you behave? What do you teach? How do you coach? How you react to critical incidents? What you do and what reasons you give for what you do. We did this because of this. So like right now, there's just this, some of you may know, there's just this whole thing going on between Ridhananda Maharaj and the GBC. So Ridhananda Maharaj was going to go to Israel and Europe right now and preach his Krishna West, and the GBC made a decision. They said, don't go anywhere until we talk to you. And he said, I want to talk to you. You know, he said, why don't you talk to me first? Why don't you just say, you know, let's just talk now. Right? So,
the global GBC.
So I was discussing this with some people, and you know, some of the leaders, and they were saying, yeah, well, the GBC probably shouldn't have done that, because then Redan and were just saying, okay, now you're banning me, you're quarantining me, you're saying I'm contaminated, I'm not allowed to go anywhere until you talk to me. You know, what does this look like for the devotee community? So the reasons the GBC are giving is, well, we've got to make sure we know what you're doing before you go. So that's a reasonable reason, isn't it? We don't want you going and doing something new until we understand what you're talking about. So there's two things there. Their action, where they said, don't go anywhere until we talk to you, rather than, okay, let's talk to you now. Let's talk to you first. So that was their action, and then their reason given. So sometimes you can do, you know, a not very good action for a good reason. You can do a good reason. You can do a good action for a bad reason. You can do a bad action for a good reason. You can do a good action for a good reason, and you can do a bad action for a bad reason. Or sometimes we've had situations where a person is falling down from the principles of Krishna consciousness, and the leaders don't tell us about it for 5 years, or 10 years, or 15 years. Why didn't you tell us? Well, we didn't want to disturb the devotees. Well, we didn't want to embarrass the person who was doing something wrong. So those are the reasons. Do you understand the difference? So a lot of the culture is, how do you respond when there's a crisis? What do you do? There was one temple where anytime there was a crisis, the temple president would ban somebody from the temple. That was his standard reaction. Anytime it was, okay, you're banned. Okay, you're banned. Okay, you're banned. So many people were banned there that now that's like their honor badge. You know, I was banned under that administration. So, you know, how do you respond to critical things? Do you respond with hearing both sides of the story? Do you respond with, you know, having some investigation? Do you respond by trying to settle the thing first? Do you respond by just saying, okay, this is the decision now, that's what you're going to do? You know, how do you deal with it? And what are the reasons that you give? Okay, we've dealt with this to promote harmony, or we've dealt with this because we want to have the best, or we've dealt with this because we want to make sure we're following all the rules. So how you deal with critical events and what reasons you give for your actions drive culture, and they can change culture. And then the criteria used for selection, reward, status, and termination. On what basis do you decide to choose people for different positions? So there was a situation somewhere in ISKCON some time ago, and I want to be as vague as possible, where we needed somebody to take a highly responsible position that normally out in the general world would be a position given to somebody who had a high level of training and education. It would normally be a position given to somebody with at least a master's degree, if not a doctoral degree or a medical degree, and someone who probably had at least 5 to 10 years of experience. And the position was given to somebody with no experience and no training and no education. And, you know, there were a few people who were challenging this and saying, why are you giving this very important position to this person with no material qualifications? And the person making the selection, who ended up prevailing, said, well, the person is very sincere. They really care. This project is very important to them, and it really matters to them, and they're willing to work hard. So that's criteria. If we sang our criteria is, you know, you're sincere, you're willing to work hard, or the other way. You know, I see sometimes in ISKCON where I know of another project where it was just the opposite, where for positions that required a lot of expertise, they hired non-devotees. And I said to them, why are you hiring non-devotees? And the person said, well, we're mostly interested in material expertise. Somebody else can add the Krishna consciousness. So the criteria you use tells us something, tells a lot actually about what the culture is. What criteria do you use to pick people for different jobs? What criteria do you use to reward people? Do you reward people because they always show up in time? Do you reward people because they do a really good job? Do you reward people because they get along well with the devotees? I was in a temple once where there was a devotee who literally got into physical fights with other devotees regularly. And severe physical fights, punching them, pulling out knives, and et cetera, et cetera. It was really severe. But he was a very good cook. So he was kept in his position because he was a good cook. So that, you know, was the criteria. And I was in a temple where it was the opposite, where there was this woman who couldn't cook to save her life. She made avocado halva. Whoa. And she once made a subji with red cabbage, boiled eggplant, and plantain. If you know what plantain is, it's like cooking bananas.
Banana.
Yeah, so cooking bananas, boiled eggplant, and red cabbage. But we kept her, you know, she was in the kitchen because she was such a nice person and she was so sincere and she got along well with everybody. So, you know, what is the criteria for selection? How do you decide? What do you reward? And everyone, you know, everyone's looking at this. Okay, what's being rewarded? What's being rewarded? What's being punished? And why do you throw people out?
It's like he's a very sincere devotee, but he cannot drive. But because he's sincere, he can drive, right?
Something like that, yes. So we do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So and different places do, you know, but this communicates our culture. What are our criteria? What people get rewarded, what people get punished, what people get status, what people are thrown out, who's not allowed to come to temples, who's not considered a member of ISKCON, what did they do wrong? What is the thing that they did wrong? And what is the thing that gives people status in the movement? Okay. I don't know if I have time to get into this. I don't think I'm going to do that. It's too long. Okay, now how do people learn the organization's culture? If somebody comes into an organization, how do they figure it out? Because remember, it's not really taught directly. And if it's taught directly, it doesn't mean anything. If I go to you and I say, our organizational culture here is we're all a big family, that doesn't mean anything to anybody. Nobody pays attention to that kind of stuff. Do you follow? No? Okay. So we learn it through the stories. What stories do people tell? Again, who's the good guys? Who's the bad guys? What's good behavior? What's bad behavior? What are the rituals of the organization? You know, we have a lot of rituals in ISKCON that have to do with establishing humility. We have a definitely a humility culture in our movement. And we have a lot of rituals related to humility. Yeah, you go to sit down in the temple room and someone hands you a cushion and you don't take it, you hand it back to them. You know, who can give the most? We have competition. Who can give the most? Who can take the least? Who can say they're the most fallen? Who can denigrate themselves the most? We have a lot of rituals like this. Yes? Yeah, so that's kind of ritual. We also have a lot of rituals about respecting people with status. You know, who we pass the ghee lamp to. So I remember I was the first female Prabhupada disciple ever to come to Slovenia the first time I came. And nobody could figure out the right rituals for me. I remember that very clearly. I was in the car coming from the airport to the temple and the person driving me was on the phone. And I said, what's the problem? And they said, we can't figure out whether we should put you in the sannyasi room or not. And I said, well, I stay in sannyasi rooms all over the world. They said, well, we weren't sure if you could sleep in the bed.
Do we serve you prasadam in guru plates?
Yeah, oh yeah, do we serve? Yeah, you were talking about that. Do we serve? So these are rituals that express the culture of an organization. What kind of place do we use? Who gets this? Who gets that? What are the criteria? What determines who gets this or that status? What different rituals we have? Tells people figure out, oh, this is what the culture is. Is that, you follow? Okay. Material symbols. What's acceptable clothes? Who gets what working space? How opulent the furniture is? We talked about leadership perks, right? Perks or benefits you get, like we said, like the cooks can make up their own plate from the kitchen. But what perks do the leaders get? Okay? And these tell people who's important in the organization. And then you see, well, why is that person important and why is this person not important? Why is this person important and this person not important? And then you can figure out what's the culture. Because we're going to give importance to people who embody the culture that we're trying to have. And then how do we talk? You know, and this is the jargon is one reason that I care about something that otherwise really doesn't have any meaning. You know, it's how women are addressed in ISKCON. And a lot of people said to me, well, does it really matter? Can you go back to Godhead depending on how... And I said, well, no, you can go back to Godhead however you talk. But it establishes a culture. Whenever we say the Prabhus and the Matajis, we're establishing a culture, because Prabhus is a spiritual term and Matajis is a material term. So you're saying, you know, we see the men through spiritual culture and we see the women through material culture. So it's... Or, you know, I've heard people say the devotees and the Matajis also. Well, the devotees sit over there and the Matajis sit over there. You know, so that kind of language, it makes a difference. It establishes a culture. And the main place to change culture is when people begin. This is the main place to change culture, because once people are thoroughly into a culture, it's hard to change it. You know, once people have been saturated with a culture for 10, 20 years, it's hard to change. It can be changed. Just like we see in the greater society right now, that attitudes about homosexuality have undergone a radical change in the last 10, 15 years, correct? Radical. I mean, completely radical. When I was growing up, you never even said the word. Basically, homosexuals didn't exist when I was a teenager. They just didn't exist. I think the first time I found out that there were such a thing as homosexuals, I was probably around 16 or 17 years old. You know, and so the culture has changed radically. So you can radically change a culture, even for people who are already adults, even for people who are already brought up in the culture. It takes a long time, and it's a very slow process. If you really want to change culture, you work with your new people. That means your children and the people just coming into the movement. That's the main... If you really want to change culture, that's the place. So we talked about the areas. These are the areas. You're going to change culture in what you pay attention to, your role modeling, teaching and coaching, how you react to critical events and how you explain your reaction, what criteria you use for selection, reward, status, and termination, for the stories that are told, the rituals that are done, the symbols, and the language. Those are the areas in which you're going to change culture. And then the times that you're going to change culture are for children and for new people. Especially. Not that you can't change for anyone else, but it's more difficult. And keep in mind that very, very, very small adjustments can bring very, very big changes. That often we have this idea that if I want to change something big, I have to do something big to change it. That is not necessarily true. Ajamil changed everything by one time saying the name Narayana. One time saying the name Narayana changed everything. One time. That was a 10-second activity that changed everything. So very, very, very small changes can have very, very big effects. Especially changes in symbols and in stories. And they can have very big effects very quickly also. Okay, we've gone for a long time. We could take just a few questions, but I don't think we have much time for more than that. Yes?
The Hungarian farm is very centered control. I think it's... Now that I was listening to the description of Bhagavad Siddhanta Saraswati, Maharaj was explaining it in Bhagavad, my subjective opinion is it's quite the opposite, but I think it's actually very successful.
I would really prefer not to talk about specific places like that, especially when the people from those places are not here. And cannot describe their own place. So I would say that having gone there for a long time, that they started out with a very hierarchical model and they definitely have moved away from it.
Yeah.
So that is something I know for sure, that there was one point where they had a very hierarchical model for a few years, and that they have very deliberately and consciously and strongly moved towards a more cooperative and even collaborative model. And you have people there who are are making it their business to make sure that they don't slide back to a very hierarchical model. Remember that a family also has a hierarchy. And they've also, you know, they experimented with centralization for a while, and then, but they're not as centralized as they used to be. So that, and when they were doing those things, there was a lot of dissatisfaction. When they were doing that for a while, there was quite a lot of dissatisfaction, and they took some very strong steps to move away from that. But I think, you know, if we're going to discuss in detail, then it's better we be there and we have those people, or those people are here, and that they can really explain what they're doing, rather than just, you know, people like us who go visit and just spend some time there or just talk to some people. That's one of the reasons I asked that we looked at the model here rather than the model of someplace else.
It's just the comparison sometimes, because here we are also evolving some ideas about things should be there.
Well, we also had a situation at one point in Europe after Prabhupada left where there was one particular leader who tried to centralize everything in Europe. There was one leader who tried to centralize everything, all the finances, all the human resources, everything. Somebody who's not in our movement anymore. So, I mean, there certainly are attempts, and even now, there are certain areas of ISKCON where people make strong attempts for centralization and bureaucracy. My own feeling about why that happens is just a lack of knowledge, would probably say a poor fund of knowledge. That people very sincerely, they want to have an organization. You know, Prabhupada wanted an organization. And in their mind, organization means centralized bureaucracy. They can't fathom, they don't even know that they're making that assumption. They don't even know that they have that belief. They think it's obvious. Well, it's obvious. If you have an organization, it's got to have centralization and bureaucracy. They don't use those words. They're saying, if you have an organization, there's got to be all these rules, and there's got to be this book that gets thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker with rules. And you've got to have strong centralized authority. Otherwise, how will it be an organization? As soon as it's decentralized, and as soon as you don't have rules, it won't be an organization anymore. It'll all split up into a gazillion pieces and be a mess. And I've heard this argument so many times that people say, it's either got to be like this or chaos. That those are your options. That if you get rid of the humongous kilometer-high rule book and you don't have central, heavy, strong centralized authority, you'll have chaos. That's simply not true. It's just not true. There's at least five kinds of organizational structure. So at least five kinds. And I haven't had the opportunity to study this, but there's also some who say there's a sixth, and that the sixth kind of organizational structure is especially suited for a religious organization. So I made a lot of effort to get the materials on that. That those efforts are partially successful, and I haven't had a chance to really study them. But there's the five main kinds of organizational structure are a machine bureaucracy, a professional bureaucracy, a divisional form, a simple structure, and an adhocracy. Those are your five main ways of having an organization. And there are organizations all over the world, in the business sector, in the nonprofit sector, in the non-government sector, that are in all of these forms. Now, what's interesting is that any organization on this Earth planet that we know of in the Kali Yuga, which is the only time we know of anybody studied this stuff, will tend towards a machine bureaucracy in time. The natural tendency of any organization is to become a highly centralized and highly bureaucratic. That's like the way that the thing is going to go that way. Why? Because as an organization gets bigger, it will encounter the same problems over and over again in space. So it will start to have a standard reaction to them. Oh, we had that problem, you know, in Peru. Oh, well, let's just deal with it in France the way we dealt with it in Peru. So the bigger you get, the more you tend to have a standardized response. And the older you get, the more you encounter the same problem in time. And the more you encounter something in time, the more you tend to have a standardized response to it and say, well, as we encounter the same problems over and over again in space and time, let's make a rule for those problems. And then as you get a different variety of that problem, then you have to tweak your rule. You have to have rule 1.6.7.8.2.7b. So that's the natural tendency. And to prevent you from going to a machine bureaucracy, you have to take make frequent, deliberate course corrections. You have to be frequent and deliberate. You have to get off that course and get to another course. But so this is what I understand. I understand that these things happen in our movement because it's the natural thing that happens in the material world with any organization. It's just like our bodies tend to decompose. Our material body will decompose. It just does. Right? And if you don't take strong actions, it will decompose very quickly. You know, you have to keep feeding it, and you have to keep putting water in it, and you have to keep bathing it, you know, or else it will decompose very, very quickly. So that's one of the problems. And the other problem is people just simply don't know. They just don't know. They don't know that there's, which is why I teach this, that you have a choice. Organizations can have different cultures. Organizations can have different structures. And you can deliberately choose which one you want. And you can choose which one is going to suit your purpose. You know, it's not a machine bureaucracy or chaos. It just isn't. That isn't reality. But I believe we're always going to have people who steer us towards a machine bureaucracy. And what happens with these people who are good, sincere people, when they read these quotes from Prabhupada, because I know, because I've talked to them, and I'll say, what about this quote from Prabhupada? What about this quote from Bhakti Sanjaya? And they'll say, well, we can't follow that because we have to have an organization. And my response is, if Prabhupada said that and Bhakti Sanjaya said that, they must have had a vision for how you could have an organization that was organic and decentralized. There must be an organizational form that's organic and decentralized. Must be. Otherwise, why would they have both established an organization and said, don't become centralized and bureaucratic? Were they crazy? Were they telling us to do something impossible? Have an organization, but make it decentralized and organic. Oh, how do I do that? But if that's your paradigm, it just doesn't make sense. So that's what I see. And it's something that especially leaders, and I mean really leaders, need to be adjusting for very frequently. Deliberately and frequently. That whenever they see signs of bureaucracy and centralization, they have to adjust course. So that we don't fall in the ocean. Is that okay? Sorry that I'm a little... You know, it's something that I would like to... I really care. And I'd like it to be something that was disseminated widely and understood widely. I mean, on the positive side, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Srila Prabhupada are ultimately in charge of what's happening. And that I see that despite some strong efforts to centralize and bureaucratize ISKCON, that the main life in ISKCON is outside of that. So like there's this area that we're really trying to centralize and make bureaucratic, but it's almost irrelevant. It's like, go ahead and make it centralized and bureaucratic. It doesn't matter. The real life is going on around it. I hope this isn't too heavy. Yes?
And you are in ISKCON, this topic was discussed and applied.
Well, the problem with my lifestyle is it's hard for me. I'm not so much involved in follow-up. So many places where it's discussed, just like I'm presenting it here, I've presented it in many places. I mean, we just presented this in Mexico City, and we got at 10 in the morning on a Tuesday morning, we got between 40 and 50 people. which amazed me. The people, and people were very interested in how they could follow up on the topic. So I do know of Pradyumna Prabhu in Leicester, UK, is somebody who's very knowledgeable on these topics and really works hard to apply them. He has his master's in business administration, but his area of expertise, which is very unusual, is in nonprofits. So most of our devotees that have MBAs are more schooled in the corporate world, whereas he's really schooled in nonprofits. And his mentor is named Margaret Harris, who's one of the experts in the organizational structure and the organizational culture of religious organizations, which is somewhat different. You know, we don't want to have the same kind of culture that you find in a place that manufactures, you know, chairs. We're trying to manufacture love of God, not chairs. So he's one person. Radhakrishna Prabhu in Hungary is another such person who's very interested in these topics and has really explored them. Another person, what's her name? Nitya something, Nitya Leela, I think, in New Zealand. She also has an MBA, and she also has done a lot of work in nonprofits. So she's not only studied nonprofits, but before coming to ISKCON, she's done a lot of work managing nonprofits. So she's very aware of organizational culture and organizational structure. She is handicapped by the fact that not only is she a woman, but she hasn't been a devotee that long, maybe 4 or 5 years. And so sometimes the people there see her as more of an outsider with her ideas. Who else is there? There's other people. I can't remember their names right now. There was a time that I was like trying to network all these people. I'm thinking maybe Pancharatna is someone who's also done some research into these things and thinks about them and is working toward them. You know, what I'd personally like to see is that, just like with what Mukunda Prabhu just did, where we were networking people for grants, you know, we brought people together from all over Europe and, oh, you're doing this? Oh, we're also doing this. So how can we do this together? That we might want to start thinking about networking people in terms of organizational culture and organizational structure, and particularly networking people, I'm sorry to say this, who know something about it, not just people who have some interest in it. Because this presentation was made to the GBC, not by me, it was made by somebody else. And the whole section on Varna was taken out. So this presentation was made to the GBC with the section on Varna removed and the quotes from Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta removed. And it was made in only, the whole presentation with the activity was done in only 40 minutes. So we've been going now here for almost 3 hours. So they did that in 40 minutes with the activity. And the result was that the GBC said they were interested in exploring organizational culture. So they set up a temporary committee to study organizational culture, but most of the people in that committee didn't have a background of training in organizational culture. So, you know, the head of the committee, who's a very dear friend of mine, and other people on the committee, they were writing to me and saying, can you help us because we don't have any idea what this is or how to do it.
I remember I was in the first semester in summer, mm-hmm. attending this area. And Sita Rama was?
Yes, he was involved.
Yeah, I was there and it's not like that. I mean, he isn't really like the overview, which is like systematic.
Yes.
Some structures that are about the top, I mean, in the area.
That's right. So, I mean, there's interest. The GBC is definitely interested, and of course they have a standing committee called Organizational Development, where they're looking at organizational culture and organizational structure.
So you're not connecting with them?
No, I'm not. No. With OrgDev, no. There. Way up there. But my point is that there's interest, so that there's interest on the part of the GBC body. There's definitely interest. And there's interest on the level of different leaders in various localities. And there's some people who have a lot of knowledge and training in this. So it's really a question of bringing together those people and starting to really ask some of these hard questions. And I mean, I think in some areas we're doing a great job. I think in some areas we really are promoting the culture that we'd like to promote. And we really are having the kind of organizational culture that we would desire. And we have many projects that have a very compatible organizational structure. And in some places it's a complete mess. And in most places it's somewhere in the middle. You know, we have places where our organizational culture is just stifling and oppressive. And we have, you know, and then we also, again, we have varieties. So depending on the particular, the culture surrounding you, you know, whether you're in Russia or whether you're in Chennai or whether you're in Mexico City, that's going to make a difference. And, you know, are the people there Indian or not Indian? Do you have a lot of people born in the movement or mostly converts? Do you have a lot of families or do you have mostly renunciates? All those things affect the local culture as well. You know, how much money does the temple have? Sometimes what kind of geographical area are you in? What sort of skill sets are people bringing in? All those sort of things affect the local culture to some extent because people are bringing in different cultures and trying to kind of Krishnaize them.
Are there any general guidelines also apply such an organization?
Oh, yes, many. Well, I've given you some here, at least in a general way. Of course. This is a huge... Raja Bihari Prabhu also knows quite a bit about organizational culture. He's the one who presented this to the GBC. There's many more. I can't think of them right offhand, but I meet them in various places in the world. You know, I've had some really wonderful discussions with devotees in various places in the world on these topics, and there's a number of people who are aware that these need to be addressed and that they're important. Oh, certainly. There's more to read than you can read in a lifetime, if you wanted to. The problem is that a lot of it is very technical. That's definitely a problem. Like, most of the material and organizational structure is extremely boring to read. It's really dry. It is very high English. I mean, it's hard for me to read. Okay? You know, so English is my native language. I have a PhD, and it's hard for me to read it. It's a struggle. So it's difficult for me to recommend a lot of this stuff because you'll read it and you go, "What are they talking about?" These academics, they have their own kind of exclusive culture where they keep people out of their realm by making the language so obtuse and difficult that nobody else can even stand to read it for half an hour. So that way they kind of keep their little enclave. So that's one of the difficulty. It's hard to find a lot of popular material on org culture and org structure that's in a very easy reading format and easy to apply and understand. I have put together a paper on centralization and bureaucracy, you know, a few page paper with Prabhupada and Bhakti Sananda's quotes. But it's something that could be developed more. I mean, this is something, you know, I've thought about writing a book on it, but I don't think I'll ever do it. I do think that we could have, and maybe the GBC body would be really appreciative of it, I don't know, it's hard to tell. But, you know, maybe we could develop some sort of an international group that was looking at these things from the point of view of people who already had a lot of training in it, and then to come up with, you know, advice for the society and guidance for the society. That would be really nice.
Or maybe they ask you to travel in Europe until they
adopt. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's always a little risky giving these sort of presentations. It's definitely always a little risky. You know, you never quite know if the culture of the place is going to be supportive of you talking about these things. Because you're bringing up things that we don't generally talk about, that we could pretend they aren't there. There's only certain temples that will ask for these sort of presentations. Anything else? So thank you. I hope you found this interesting and helpful and enlightening. Please excuse me for any and all ways in which I may have said something disturbing. Some of these are They're a little disturbing, and I'm sorry if there was any disturbance in you.